Fred Silverman, NBC President. At that point in time, Saturday Night Live was doing very well in the ratings, which is why, although occasionally it would annoy me, I never let it annoy me too much, because it was like an oasis in the schedule. It was extremely profitable. It and The Tonight Show brought in hundreds of millions of dollars every year. But then we began very serious conversations about giving Gilda Radner her own variety hour in prime time. That was very, very much a part of my planning for mid-season. I think it was 1978, the first mid-season I was there for. And, you know, she was doing it, she was doing it, she was doing it. And then we had a lunch, just Gilda and Lorne and myself. And I found out at that lunch that she decided with Lorne that they weren't going to do it after all. And that was an enormous disappointment on several levels. On a personal level, but also because I thought she would have been an absolute smash doing the kind of show that Carol Burnett used to do. It would have been great. When you're running a network, you search for a signature program. And in the days of BJ and the Bear and Sheriff Lobo, to put on a smart variety show with Gilda Radner coming out of the studios in New York would have been a home run. So that was an enormous disappointment. It certainly didn't help my relationship with Lorne at that point in time. Lorne Michaels. Somewhere around the time she did the Broadway show, Gilda decided she did not want to do the Variety Hour. And somewhere in that time, Bernie Brillstein claims, he conveyed to NBC that Gilda did not want to do this primetime hour. So imagine my surprise when I was summoned to Fred's office and shown the board, and there on Wednesday nights is Gilda's show. So I say, "Fred, that's not happening." She said no. Well, it got very heated between the two of us. He said some unpleasant things about her. I defended her. We stood toe-to-toe and had a very deep exchange. I think he thought I wasn't delivering Gilda as promised. Alan Zweibel. By the fifth year, there was a mass burnout. There was the thought, for me personally, gee, I'd like to try to do something else. Max Pross, writer. When Tom Gammel and I worked for Lorne, I thought, oh my God, this is the best job I'll ever have in my life. Coming out of college, it just seemed like, oh, this is great, you know? It was 1979, and we were, what, 22? And probably the two funniest people in the world for me were Bill Murray and Steve Martin. And I got to meet them both my first day of work. How cool was that? Not only met them, I got to, like, work with them. Tom Gammel, writer. And you had all these amazing bands. I mean, the Grateful Dead hung out there for like a week. We went out to restaurants all the time. Plus, you only worked 22 weeks out of the year, because the weeks that the show wasn't in production, people didn't come into the office. Although Max and I used to come in just because we wanted someplace to go. Max Pross. We got such a skewed idea of what the working world was like. We get this job where people act like college kids, staying up all night and smoking pot and drinking beer all the time. Boy, were we in for a letdown when we saw the way the rest of the world operated. Tom Gammel. Our next big job was at Letterman, where it's like, wait, where are the parties? You'll get a party if we last a year. There wasn't any beer. Harry Shearer. Chevy was back as the host of the show, and it was the first of many occasions when Lorne assured the cast that, I don't know, Chevy's cleaned up. I learned that wasn't exactly true when I saw the sweat on his brow when we were actually doing the show on the air. But anyway, we were doing this talk show bit, and Garrett's not there. We're doing camera blocking, and Garrett Morris is nowhere on the floor. And then I heard the euphemism, "Garrett's on 17." That meant that Garrett was up on the 17th floor, where the offices were, and that he would be indulging in some substance, rather than being down at the stage on 8, where he was expected. Garrett Morris. I've been described as being the worst person in the world in terms of drugs. Now, we know that turned out not to be so. My attitude toward drugs has been indifferent. I'm not saying that excuses it. I don't know why marijuana is still illegal. It has never killed one single individual in all the time we've known about it, yet tobacco kills 300,000 each year. Alcohol kills 250,000 each year, and they are legal. The laws, the whole thing, has been the right wing trying to get back at the civil rights movement. What can we do to reverse it? If we can put them in the fucking buses, we would, but we can't do that. As far as I'm concerned, that's all I see.
Jane Curtin. Garrett was treated horribly, horribly, by the writers, by some of the performers, and Lorne. They just dismissed him. I used to have conversations on the set with Garrett about, why do you put up with this? And he said, I can't pass up the money. I'm going to make the money and get out and go on and do something else. I found it amazing that he let it go on for as long as it did. But it took its toll. It clearly took its toll on Garrett.
Garrett Morris. I got so many years of Uncle Tom letters, especially when I did the Monkey and the Whiz. I like to do stuff that's out of line. Nobody tells me how to think, not even black people, so that's why I did the Monkey. The rest of them can kiss my ass. Now, the same people who criticized me for doing the Monkey and the Whiz are doing Donkeys in Shrek and making millions of dollars. I guess that's what I get for being ahead of my time. I had 5 years of building what everybody knows is a chair there, the only non-white chair in that whole thing, and I shed the blood for that. So at least if people don't want to say something good, they should not say anything at all, because I've done nothing to deserve anybody to come after me saying a lot of bullshit. Harry Shearer. I knew that everybody in the original cast had a 5-year contract, and this was the 5th year. So I knew that despite Billy and Gilda, you know, poor Gilda, but I called her up and went over to her place because I was trying to find some advice from everybody there as to what the fuck I should do. And Gilda just said, do whatever Lorne says, which I understood coming from her, but which was of no use to me. Fred Silverman. Saturday Night Live was an enormous hit and a major profit center. It was the only show on the network that was reaching that particular demographic. I looked at Saturday Night Live and said, thank God it's here. And I really tried my best just to stay out of their way. And if they wanted to take some shots at me, fine, let them do it. I didn't care. Dick Ebersol. Fred fired me in 1979, although he did not have the guts to do it himself. He had a triumvirate of folks do it. I was running comedy, variety, and specials at the time. Alan Zweibel. John was on the cover of Newsweek by himself when Animal House came out, and there wasn't anyone from the rest of the cast there with him. I think if there was a demarcation point as far as I was concerned, that may have been it. Things changed. All of a sudden there was a world that was dangling temptations. John's a star now by himself. John's getting $1 million, or whatever it was, by himself. Gilda was given a one-woman show on Broadway. Billy did Meatballs. John did Goin' South, and he and Danny did the Blues Brothers movie. And I think those last few years that I was there, one of Lorne's greatest tasks was to keep everybody together. So it wasn't just, let's put on a fun show. It was, let's keep this together. And what happened was, there was a competition. There were studio executives starting to hang out in 8H during blocking, asking, who wrote that sketch? They were looking for sitcom writers or movie writers.
Marilyn Suzanne Miller. Lorne died with the show. If things didn't go well, he torpedoed. They'd go up there in those first years immediately after the air show and watch the tape within seconds. In the earliest years, they were together night and day, day and night. At night, it's the party. The next morning, you'd go to the Russian tea room and have brunch. And it was always about, we will try harder. Everybody was this animatronic personality who was going to do better. And it was all for the show and giving up things for the show. The emotional component was so great for everyone involved.
Dan Aykroyd. It's too stressful because you worry about quality. You want things to be so right, and that really weighs heavily. Plus the adrenaline pump, it's like being in combat or a cop or something. You can't take that week after week. It's a young man's game, there's no doubt about it. It is satisfying when you pull something off, and it is tremendously debilitating and anxiety-producing when you don't. Bill Murray. I only became sort of important to the show after Danny and John went to do the Blues Brothers and quit. When they were doing the Blues Brothers, all of a sudden I started getting a lot to do. And when they were gone, then I really got a lot to do. Then I was in lots and lots and lots and lots of sketches. When you have this celebrity thing, different things change. Your vision is different, and I was sort of like in the wake of all these people. I didn't have as many famous friends, and I didn't necessarily work certain parts of town. So I was just doing what I was doing, and happy enough to do that. I was still trying to be not famous on some level. And I still was not famous on some level. So I was able to enjoy that part of it and see that the famous part of it had its downside. I was busy mining the parts of my life where I was not famous, because I saw that those were not going to last forever. Professionally, I just kept doing my job, because I was pretty good at it, and I became valuable those last couple years, and I was proud of the work I did. I thought I worked hard. I was a little late sometimes, but I thought I worked pretty well, and I never had, like, brawls or feuds with the girls or anything. Even network executives became embroiled in backstage melodrama, especially toward the end of SNL's raucous infancy, when NBC was getting a double drubbing, terrible ratings in prime time, and even worse press. Fred Silverman, having a spectacularly stormy reign as network president and already feeling under siege, saw Saturday Night Live graduate from being a source of occasional irritation to being a major, gaping trouble spot. Al Franken picked this painful moment to compose a savage piece of satire called Limo for a Lamo, one of the meanest acts of character assassination in the history of, well, in the history of mean acts of character assassination. Franken, addressing the camera, told viewers Silverman had done a lousy job running the network and didn't deserve the limousine that was one of his lavish perks, whereas Franken, star of a hit show, did. He invited viewers to write to Silverman demanding that Franken be given the use of a limo. More than 5,000 letters, nastily addressed to the Lamo, deluged on an infuriated Silverman's office. Already incensed about losing the Gilda Radner variety hour that he thought would rescue his regime, and assuming the Franken sketch to have been part of a staff conspiracy at Saturday Night Live, Silverman broke off communication with Michaels and never consulted him about who his replacement as executive producer should be. Michaels wanted Franken. The limo sketch certainly put the kibosh on that. Lorne Michaels. I was going back and forth about whether to come back or not. All I really wanted was time. Since the election was coming up in the fall, and they always threw us out of 8H for election coverage in those days, I was looking for some downtime after the season ended. I'd worked the summer before on Gilda's Broadway show, and I wanted this summer off, plus just a month or two of recovery time. So basically I wanted to start up again after the 1980 election. That was what I wanted creatively. The business questions of what I wanted, or of what I have to this day, had been solved at the end of the third season, when my contract was first up. So it wasn't a money issue at all. And that fifth season, Fred Silverman was running a Best of Saturday Night Live in prime time for 13 weeks, so in every way we were at the peak of being exploited. Or, to put it another way, the peak of overexposure. We were limping to the finish line. Gilda had said she would stay with me. There were a couple people I knew who would still be there. But the big piece of information was that I was going to have to really recast and reinvent the show. I was going to have to fire some people, many of whom had lived up to the top of their talent. But the mistake was made 5 years earlier in the hiring. Quite often the least talented are the ones who most want you to know how loyal they are. And if I did return, I'd have to give up all thoughts of directing movies or whatever else I thought I might want to do with my life. Brandon Tartikoff had been given the task of either trying to get me to come back or getting a replacement. I think he had more than enough problems with Silverman as it was, and Freddie was a screamer. I was supposed to have met with Fred, but he had stayed out late the night before and canceled the meeting. Bernie took this as a sign of lack of respect. I did know they were making Tom Snyder's New Deal and Johnny Carson's New Deal, So the emphasis seemed to be on on-air talent as opposed to dealing with a producer, which they weren't used to. It just wasn't a priority. I don't think they understood the part a producer played in that kind of a show. Anyway, Fred apologized profusely, and our meeting was rescheduled for the following Monday. That weekend, Al Franken does Limo for a Lamo, which is a direct fucking assault on Fred Silverman. I see it for the first time, as I do with Update, at dress rehearsal. Brandon Tartikoff comes over to me, and he's laughing at it because it's very funny and it killed with the audience. I say to Brandon and Barbara Gallagher, who worked directly for Fred, "You should let Fred know. Don't blindside him on this. You don't want to be sitting in your house and suddenly Al Franken is attacking Fred." But neither Brandon nor Barbara made the call, I think because at the time they were both frightened of him. So what happens is, Fred Silverman is blindsided by this thing at home and goes into a complete rage. He thinks that I'm responding to his canceling the meeting with me by calling him a lame-o on national television. And what are you going to say, that it wasn't me? Then he'd think I'm such a wuss that I allow Al Franken to just steamroll me against my own better career instincts. Anyway, it all blows up, and that's that. And then his hurt feelings lead to my hurt feelings. It all seemed to be end-of-season emotions, which are just end-of-season emotions, that time when you never want to see anybody again, ever. The upshot of it all was that Fred took it personally, and that put a further strain between him and me. And we never did meet. Fred Silverman. I never liked Al Franken to begin with. You don't mind it if somebody like John Belushi gets up there and makes jokes about you, because I respected his talent and he was funny. But I thought this piece that Franken did was just very mean-spirited and not very funny. I don't think I called Lorne about it. I think I sent a letter, a note or something, to Franken, and said in no uncertain terms that I thought he was way off base and that I wasn't going to forget it. And I believe he left the show shortly thereafter. I don't believe he stayed on the show very long. I don't think Lorne put the sketch in there to be mean. He never did a sketch to be mean. That was not his style. I never blamed Lorne personally. Warren Littlefield, NBC executive. Brandon was sitting in the audience, and they had just done the limo sketch, and a page comes over and says, "Mr. Tartikoff, you have a phone call." And he says, "Who is it?" And the page goes, "A screaming Mr. Silverman." Brandon stopped for a second and then asked, "Did you tell him that you knew where I was?" The page said, "No, we were just told to find you." Brandon said, "Okay, then tell him you can't find me." Brandon just couldn't take it. Here it was, midnight on Saturday night, and he just couldn't take Fred screaming at him at that hour. We always thought that was a wonderful lesson that Brandon was imparting to us about survival in the executive ranks.
Barbara Gallagher, NBC Vice President. I went to Lorne when I saw the Limo for a Lamo sketch in rehearsal. He said, "Too much, huh?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Go talk to Franken." So I go over to Al, and Al goes, "Wasn't that the greatest? Didn't you love it?" I said, "Al, I'm not going to censor you. It's not my job. I'm just telling you it's pretty dicey right now. Fred's in a bad way, and this is really going to hurt him." And Al said, "Good, because he hurt Lorne." So I went back to Lorne, and Lorne said, "I'll take care of it." Well, the bit was worse when it came on the air. I was home watching the show. The phone rang. It was Fred. When he couldn't get Brandon, he called me. He said, "Did you know about this?" I said, "I did." He said, "And you didn't do anything about it?" I said that I'd told Al we weren't going to censor him, but that it was too much. Fred said, "You call Lorne and tell him how hurt I am. And how could he do that? How could he let that go on at this time?" Fred had offered Lorne the world to stay on at Saturday Night Live. He wanted him to stay. He'd said, "Whatever you need, whatever you want, just stay." So I call over to Lorne, and Al gets on the phone and says, "So, Fred's pissed at me?" I said, "No, Al, he's not mad at you." Al said, "Well, it's not Lorne's fault." I said, "Yeah, it is. He's the producer. Al said, Lorne lets us do what we want to do. I said, Fred is really hurt. If you heard his voice, he is really hurting. So Lorne gets on the phone. He says, is he mad? I said, no, he's hurt, and he's blaming you. I was right in the middle of all this. And if you know me, I hate confrontation. I'm worse than Lorne. I will run 3,000 miles the other direction or get a root canal before I have a confrontation. I hate it. And I really like Lorne. We'd gotten along great. But he has been cool to me now for a long time. I think he feels I betrayed him, and I didn't. I truly didn't. I was walking a fine line, and I was ready for a loony bin. It was horrible. I saw what was happening to Fred, too. And if Lorne didn't take time off, Lorne would have been in a loony bin as well. He was hanging by a string. He was so tired. I frankly worried about him, too. Both of them.
Lorne Michaels. I'd given so much energy to holding things together all those years. I had been truly drained, just spent. I was just burnt out and emotionally very vulnerable. So I told Brandon I couldn't do another year. He didn't try and change my mind, and I said to myself, all right, I guess that's it. I've done my 5 years. It was very hard for me. In retrospect, to be relieved of the show was an emotional withdrawal that took me truly years to get a perspective on. I began looking at studio deals and went back and forth between Paramount and Warner Brothers, and I met with Gene Domanian about it, and I said, if I go to Paramount, I'd love you to come with me. And she implied, yes, that's what I came away with. Several weeks later, I was on my way to the opening of Urban Cowboy when I got a phone call from Brandon saying, I'm going to name Gene Domanian as the next producer of the show. I go, really? That's an interesting choice. I was startled because I always think of the show as a writer-based show, and you have to be a writer to say what is funny or not funny. To control that many people in comedy without having any credits yourself in comedy is impossible. Gene called me 5 minutes after Brandon did. I asked her, when did they talk to you? And she said, 6 weeks ago. That was the part where I went, what? And then she said, they made me promise not to talk to you. That was the very first moment of my growing up. They asked me not to talk to you. And this was when I'd been talking to her about coming to Paramount with me. Now, Brandon was not an innocent in all of this. I don't mean that meanly. I mean it in the sense that I had thought, because he and I were friendly, that he would at least listen to me about my replacement. I had told him I would use some combination of Jim Downey and Al Franken and Tom Davis, because it had to be someone with writing credentials who understood how the show really worked. Gene wasn't even there for the meetings between Dress and Air.
Barbara Gallagher. It wasn't a conspiracy to do Lorne in. Lorne was leaving. He wanted Al, Fred wasn't buying it, so there we were. They also didn't want to leak it to the press. They didn't want anyone to know yet. And if Lorne knew, it would have been all over the town. So that was the reason for not telling him. It wasn't a conspiracy to do anything to Lorne.
Fred Silverman. The decision to hire Gene Domanian was made by Brandon Tartikoff based on a recommendation from Barbara Gallagher. I didn't know Jean. I knew she had worked with Woody Allen. I said, if you recommend her, fine.
Barbara Gallagher. Lorne didn't want Gene Domanian in there for some reason, probably because she's not a writer. But Fred Silverman did not want an outsider coming in. He wanted someone from the show who'd been with the show. And Gene had been there forever, worked with the talent, and Gene wanted the job. I said, Gene, I'll talk to Fred about it. Lorne wanted Al Franken and Tom Davis to produce the show, and Fred said no, he didn't want Al, because of what they'd gone through. Brandon was there at the time, and I said the only other person down there who knows how to run the show, because she's been sitting there all the time, although she's not a writer, is Gene. And he said, oh, all right, let's run it by Fred. I said, I know Lorne doesn't want her, so if you tell Lorne you're going to have a big craziness going on. Fred said, well, if that's the only person down there and you think she'll be all right. And I said, everyone likes her. They all know her. What problem could it be? Robin Schlynn. Woody Allen was best friends with Gene Demanian, who was the associate producer when I was there, and he would call the control room constantly and talk to her. Woody Allen would always call as Mo Golden. And the second day I was there, I got this call for Gene Demanian and had to say, Gene, it's Mo Golden calling. We always had to answer the control room phone. I didn't think anything of it, and then somebody said, it's Woody Allen. We never knew if she knew that we knew. We had to pretend that we all thought this guy calling her was Mo Golden and not Woody Allen. He called all the time. Sometimes it was like every 5 minutes, and we were just like, what the fuck?
James Downey. Jean was like a fashion person. It was all about restaurants and clothes and stuff. She didn't seem to me to have much of a sense of humor. The only time I've gone to a party where I was kind of awestruck was when she called me and said, Woody Allen's going to have a party. And Woody Allen apparently never had parties. And when she called me, she said, don't tell anybody else. It was like 1980, 81, and I went with my college girlfriend. It was in Woody's house. I thought it was his house because it was a townhouse. You went upstairs. You actually met him at the door, and he, like, stayed there the whole evening with Jean, who would assure him that whoever came through the door was not a dangerous or menacing person. Walt Frazier was the first person I saw, then John Lindsay. It was a very New York thing, and the best collection of camera-shy, publicity-shy, retiring-type people I'd ever seen. Paul Newman was there, Truman Capote, even Jackie Kennedy. In one of the last sketches of Saturday Night Live's fifth season, Lorraine Newman played a noblewoman, Garrett Morris played a butler, writers Jim Downey and Tom Davis played Lords Worcestershire and Wilkinson, of sauce and razor blade fame, respectively, Jane Curtin was Lady Wilkinson, Bill Murray played the Earl of Sandwich. I'm afraid nothing has been named after a member of my family, he lamented. His brother Brian Doyle Murray was a servant, and host Buck Henry joined Gilda Radner to play the principal characters of the sketch, Lord and Lady Douchebag. The setting was the manor of Lord Salisbury, whose steaks were served to the guests, and the year 1730. My dear Sandwich, said Henry in character, Parliament has always had its share of douchebags, and it always will. And on this mildly satirical and intentionally ridiculous note, what was left of the original cast and creators of Saturday Night Live would soon part, never to perform together again. The stakes were being pulled up and the circus was leaving town. It was May 24th, 1980, the end of the fifth season, but also of an era. Lorne ended the last show on a shot of the on-air sign going off.
Gene Demanian. I think Lorne would have stayed on, but NBC wouldn't give him the deal he wanted, so he went away. Lorne wasn't very happy about me getting the job, because after all, it was Lorne's baby, and he wanted Franken and Davis to get it. But Silverman didn't want them, and Brandon didn't want them either. They thought that I could do it. I had been in every writer's meeting when Lorne was producing. I had seen how the writing was done. Besides, Lorne really wasn't writing. He was editing and selecting. I took the job because I thought it would be a challenge. There was no other woman doing a live 90-minute television show, and I wanted to see if I could do it. I did want to keep several writers, but I think everybody was advised not to stay on. I don't know who advised them, but four writers said they would stay, and then they had a change of heart and came back and said they couldn't. In fact, everybody who said they would stay reneged once word got out.
Lorne Michaels. I had no problem with people staying with their jobs. That was not a problem for me. I think in the case of Franken, Davis, Downey, and a couple others who were the people I had nominated to succeed me, because they embodied the writing perspective, Gene didn't want them. What happened was everyone got a memo from Gene to clear out their offices by July. Now, this had been a group that had lived there for 5 years. That was what killed everything when she made that one big mistake. It was a signal of, you know, a new broom. I didn't get the memo because I'd left. For guys like Franken and that, it was the first sign that they weren't even being considered to stay.
Lorraine Newman. I was dying to go home. On the other hand, I knew, having grown up in Los Angeles, what it was like to have been on a series and to no longer be on one. I knew what it was that I was facing, to have been on a hit show and then be an unemployed actor. So I was a little worried about that. Mostly I was glad to be back in L.A., because I love New York for about 5 days, but after that it's just utter toil. I came from a car culture. Not being able to drive myself around is like imprisonment to me. Jane Curtin. I was happy to move on. I was tired. You get very burned out after doing something like that, and you get very jaded. It was very hard to deal with going from relative obscurity to everybody knowing who you are. I had to deal with what I had become. It was hard to deal with on the show because you were busy doing the show. So I had to come to terms with what I had become and try to adjust to that. I needed time off.
Alan Zweibel. I left when Lorne left in May of 1980, and I was there from day one, which was July 75. What had happened was the show changed. It stopped being fun the way it was originally. At the risk of sounding naive, this is what was going through our minds at the time, and it was only after all of us left that there was some perspective on it. We were all these neophytes that got together. You know, it was Marilyn Miller saying, "Hey, kids, let's put on a show." Nothing was sacred, and we had fun.
Robin Schlynn. I dream about those days, actually. I dream about those people a lot. When I was transitioning into my new career, I had a lot of dreams from that old time. As a psychotherapist, I realized what an amazing and important life experience it was for me, and I think for everybody else who worked during that time. I now give talks on therapeutic humor, and I'm always thinking about the time that I was in a work situation where I had so much laughter in a day. Working on that show gave me great confidence in my own sense of humor, because I was able to make people like John Belushi laugh.
James Downey. We all left in 1980. The cast and the writers all sort of agreed we would leave and take the show with us. In fairness, you'd have to say that the only reason we're even talking about this, the only reason the show's still on the air, is because of what went on in the first 5 years. First, it gave it this tremendous momentum that it could survive anything, like the Gene Dumanian period or some other bad period. Then it reached the point where it was beyond good or bad. Gilbert Gottfried said a great thing one time. He said, at this point, it's just a restaurant in a good location. But even so, it's a good location because of those first 5 years. It had been a blighted neighborhood. It was Saturday night when no one was watching TV and they were showing reruns of Johnny Carson. And so it was gentrified. People went in there and did the equivalent of cleaning up vacant lots and forming neighborhood watch committees and just spiffed it up and took a chance and turned it around.
Rosie Schuster. I left at the end of year 5, after the first 5 years that Lorne did. After that, the Ayatollah Dumanian came in. Ann Beats. Lorne sheltered us from the realities of show business. It's interesting, because while some people might have thought SNL was a dangerous world, I think in many ways it was a very safe world. We were protected. We were in this little cocoon in the RCA building. We were pampered, and we got our way most of the time. When I got to Hollywood and found out the harsh truths, I wasn't really prepared.
Bill Murray. I was definitely going to go when everyone else left. I'd been at Second City when that sort of thing happened. I knew there was no point in being the one guy who knows how to do it. You've got to get the hell out of there. It's a little like lifeboat, you know? It was just time to go. I would never have wanted to start up with a whole new group. It was really a great thing to be a part of it. The fact that it was live made it performance-driven. You were always pushing yourself physically to keep your spirit going and get out there and do it. The writing had to be good, too. It was great fun and really hard work. That's the part nobody seems to know. How hard it was. What it was like to be young and exhausted all the time. Lorne did build in this great thing where we had every fourth week off. We all got a chance to blow off some steam and to rest. After 3 weeks, we'd be pretty beaten down. We'd come walking in there on our knuckles or our knees. When the show ended, it was difficult for some of us in the outside world. Difficult for each person, relative to how much they'd already been working on the outside. None of us wanted any TV jobs, because we'd had the best TV jobs there were. Once you saw what the other jobs were like, you knew they were not half as much fun as Saturday Night Live had been. On sitcoms, you're working on these little bitty scripts for hours and hours and hours. They just keep shooting and shooting and shooting. Ours was the best situation, because you had the pressure of having to do it when the time came. Then at 1 o'clock in the morning, you were done. It was over. So nobody wanted regular TV or prime time. We'd all made more money than we needed in the short term. So we just went out there and got into the movie business.
Kate Jackson. After I had hosted the show, we went to the bar that John and Dan owned, and Joni Mitchell was there, and there were musicians and other writers, and it was a terrific group of people to be around in such a small room. But it got to be time for me to leave, because I had an early flight in the morning, and Billy Murray walked me out to the car. I got in and closed the door, and as we were beginning to pull out, I turned around and looked behind me, and there was Billy, standing in the street, waving. Snow was falling all around him, just the sweetest thing. I had been terrified of hosting. I was so afraid, but I knew that I had to do it. It was one of those things where you're really afraid to do something, and you know you have to take the chance. You just have to push yourself and do it. And I remember saying to a friend of mine who went with me, "Well, I'll never do that again, because it will never get that good again." That was as good as it gets.
Lorne Michaels. I took my name off the show, and I left.